This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Why, hello, friends, grievers, grief-curious folk, family, lovers, whoever it is that's listening to a good cry. This is your friend, Michael Cruz Kane, coming at you with another episode. We took a surprise week off last week for Thanksgiving, just, you know, refresh, restore, you got to do it. And in that off week, I got a lot of messages from people via DM on Instagram or Twitter, and also on my email, which is agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. I'm working my way through responding to all of those. I will get to you if I haven't gotten to you yet. Thank you so much for these messages. They're amazing. I mean, so personal and thoughtful, and many of them provocative as well. Get me thinking about a lot of stuff. So I really appreciate them. Please message me if you want to. And if you don't want to, you know what I say? Go ahead and don't. We also want to thank, and when I say we, I mean me, we want to thank the listeners, the sharers, the subscribers, the raters, all of you. Thanks so much. You are the true superstars of America and also the world, dare I say it. Now, on to some brief thoughts. This week, my guest is the fantastic comedian, writer, actress, etc., Megan Neuringer. And she got me thinking about a very common turn of phrase in death speak, which is to say that you lost your loved one. I lost my son. I lost my sister. I lost my husband, my father, whomever. Because the idea of losing someone implies the idea that they can be found, you know? Right? I lost my dad. He's just in a coat that I put in the closet by accident. Or, you know, maybe my mom just is behind the couch someplace or underneath the car, or I left her on the airplane. And so at some point, I'm going to find her again. Maybe it's better to just say die. It has that finality to it. Like, now that person is gone. It's done. It's over with. I don't know if that works either. Like, there's really no perfect way to encapsulate the thing it is we feel or the things that we think, because we only have words, right? And words are imperfect, which is something that Megan talks about a little bit in this episode. Megan has lost her sister and both of her parents. I did it again. Right away, I said lost. Megan's sister and parents have all died. So she has experienced compounded grief, like grief of a loss when she was a child to losses as she got older. And it's starting to sound redundant when I say this, but the way that she talks about these things is so thoughtful and beautiful. And yet again, I feel like I'm just kind of a bumbling idiot listening to these geniuses talk about something in a way that is transformative for the listener, or at least it was for me. The person you lost, do you think that they died or that they're lost, and that in some way you can continue to find them? I think that might be possible, even if it's definitely not logical or literal. Maybe we do lose them in a way and can find them in other ways. Or maybe that's bullshit. I don't know. Something to think about. This is another episode of A Good Cry. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. So just to let you know before we get into it, we're going to be talking about grief in case
what?
It's a...
I thought I was promoting my new underwear line. Are you sure this isn't about?
Do you have that? Because we could do a side. We could do a spinoff podcast.
Yes. Listen, I just want to. I'm on here to sell panties, but if I have to tie it into grief, I think I can do it.
So the question that we start with, Megan, is what is your relationship to grief, which can be interpreted in a lot of ways. But I'll let you have at it.
Okay. I mean, I did listen to podcasts, but I forgot that that was like the start, my relationship to it. My relationship to even a question is like a neurotic meltdown. So my answer, so now I'm already overthinking how I even approach this, even though I shouldn't, but now I've begun to sweat. And looking for the ultimate metaphor, it's probably like if you feel like there's a bad smell in your house, but you don't know where the smell is coming from, but it's like always there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're so used to it that you don't smell it, and you can smell other things that smell good, but eventually you're going to be like, is that mold or what is that? What is that? And it turns out it's grief. It's your psyche reeks of sadness, but you get used to the smell.
Yeah. Okay. That's lovely. Do you think other people can come in and smell the grief? Do they notice?
Oh, I'm sure. Well, it depends on their sensitivity or their relationship to grief.
Yeah.
If they can see it in you because they've had it potentially, or your coping mechanisms maybe are similar.
Because that is almost like a superpower, I feel like, to be able to detect other people's grief and to be like, let's talk about what smells in here. Where I feel like most people would just enter your home, which reeks of grief, and be like, well, we'll just spray a little Lysol in here and forget all about it completely.
I'm sure it depends on how people like to relate to it. There are people who are, they do a coating over it that, to extend this metaphor, that
yeah, let's keep going.
Makes it smell worse. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you'd rather just smell the shit in the bathroom than whatever that weird candle is, because now it smells like candle and shit, which my metaphor is, you don't always have to be fake happy if you're sad. You could just be sad, the feeling will change, and then you're on to another feeling.
Yes, let's just all agree, it smells like bathroom right now, and it won't always smell like this, but it does right now.
Yeah.
My son died, and he was a twin. He is a twin. You lost your sister, who's a twin sister.
Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, immediately, first of all, I know about your son and your situation, even before this podcast. I mean, I know you. I never approached you to talk about it from my perspective or to offer any kind of real condolence, because it was...
Yeah, and I'm mad about that.
Yeah, no, but I think for so long I wasn't able to acknowledge my own loss and then to think about somebody my age who was having that loss, but for their child, in the perspective, and to feel that perspective of my parent. It was like so heavy that I was like, I would never know what to say, even though I would be potentially a good person to say something.
Yeah.
Anyway, always had a very quiet, intriguing feeling about you, because even you saying just now at the start of this podcast, he was a twin, is a twin. That, like, the tense you're using is something I struggle with all the time.
Yeah.
So just hearing you say that, immediately I'm relating to it, because you saying was a twin, is a twin, what is, was, is, you know, something.
Yeah, I mean, that when people ask me how many kids I have, it depends on my specific mood at that time, whether I'm going to be like, well, a thing that I'll do a lot is I'll say, I have two kids at home, is my answer to their question, which is like my way of being like, I'm not, it's my omission of Fisher without lying. Or, you know, I'll say I have two kids, or sometimes depending on whatever the day has been, I'll be like, I have three kids, but one of them is dead. I'm never articulate in the moment when I'm trying to suss out what the thing is that I'm going to say.
I feel that way too. And have struggled with it since I was almost 10 years old and lost my sister.
Yeah.
You know, and I always felt like part of the omission was to take care of other people more than myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to bum them out if I said, oh, I have, you know, three siblings, but one died, because that's going to ruin their day. My day's already been ruined. I already have the info. But if I have to, if I drop that on somebody who's just asking like a date question, whoops.
So. Yeah, it has like the vibe of like you want to taste something that's really terrible. Like try this.
Yeah,
like to the 4 millionth power.
You end up oversharing just by answering like a polite question. You're the weirdo who overshared, and you're like, no, I was just being honest.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
So you lost your sister when you were 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, just to talk about articulation, even when I say the phrase lost, does that feel wrong?
You're talking to a writer.
Yeah.
And so all words are always just a disappointing approximation to a feeling, and you're just striving for the closest thing that could describe the thing. So, and then I have my own opinion about euphemisms for death. The older I get, I just become less interested. I'm like, what are we protecting?
Yeah.
So I like to say my sister was murdered. No, she was not. But she was not lost. She was killed by a speeding motorist crossing the street.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so she wasn't lost. I didn't lose her. I mean, she died.
And you were there when it happened also, right?
Yes, I watched her. Yes, she got hit by a car in front of me while we were walking from school to Hebrew school. And we had stopped at a hot dog stand. And I don't know why she ran across the street while we were waiting to get our hot dogs, but she did. And when she did, a car hit her. And that was that.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to, I think it was it This American Life that you, where you mm-hmm. talked about it?
Yeah.
Just before this, which may have been emotionally an error for me because it just brought up so much, but also the way you talk about it is, well, you said that you're a writer, but you're just like a brilliantly expressive person and you have thoughts that are uncommon about a situation that's very uncommon. And like, you're the first person I talked to who could really in any way relate to what happened to us
mm-hmm.
because you're a twin. And obviously we come at it from very different perspectives, but the loss of a sibling is, you're the first person I've talked to who's had what I would, I guess, describe as like relatively an uncommon loss. Like most of the people who I've spoken to have lost their parents, which I know that mm-hmm. your mother passed away from cancer recently, right?
I actually have lost both my parents now to cancer.
Both your parents. Okay, wow.
Yes. So I do deserve some kind of medal. I'm just saying if there's like...
You're checking all... I think if there's...
The griefies. Somebody nominate me for the griefies because I have to win something in this lifetime.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of a conversion chart of like how sad each particular kind of loss is. And you can mm-hmm. like, you know, one sibling is equal to this many of whatever other thing. But a lot of the conversations I've had have been about people with similar losses. But I think losing a sibling is like an unnatural loss. It's a thing that's not supposed to happen when you're young, like losing a child.
Yeah.
A miscarriage is almost different because so many people miscarry and people lose children all the time too. People's children die, but it's less common and it does feel more, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but it feels more isolating because even people whose parents have died will, when I talk to them about death, will be like, yeah, but yours is different, which I agree with,
mm-hmm.
but it still feels like, you know, when you watch the movie that's meant to be the movie about grief,
mm-hmm.
they're like, yeah, but we're not going to fuck with somebody's kid who died because that's like too much. We're not going to talk about a child. That seems too far.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I used to think about this a lot, the idea of like the sad Olympics, you know, who's winning? And when you start to get comparative about which loss is heavier or more devastating, you know, for a long time, I was very protective of other people and their loss. I was like, you can't compare it. If somebody's never lost anybody, but they have grief about something, I'm going to allow that to be equal to the grief over my sister. And then now I'm going to allow, if somebody has grief over the loss of their pet, I'm going to say that if they think it's equal to them, to me losing my parents and my twin sister, I'm going to, you know, me, the judge in this court of non-law, I'm going to allow it. But I'll be honest, like, lately, I'm like, who are you trying to protect and why do you need to be so fair? And no, it's not the same. And losing a child, I think, is the ultimate devastation. So I do think parents who lose young children, even having lost my twin, I'm like, no, that's the worst thing I can imagine.
Well, because you must have seen, at least through your child's eyes, what it did to your parents, which I would imagine is like...
Yes, devastating.
Because I talked with my wife after listening to you on This American Life. I was like, do you think it would have been, you know, this is obviously, again, the insufficiency of words, but like, do you think it would have been better if Fisher had lived to be 9 mm-hmm. and then died then? And she was like, that's not really a question that you can even answer, because of course you would, if you're like, I could get one more day with him, I would take the one more day. There's no question about it. But then you've accumulated all of this extra love, for lack of a better word, and the impact of losing him would probably be, you know, if it seems impossible, but infinitely more.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's so funny how, like, all it does, it forces the imagination to create these hypotheticals, you know, and I think that's why people are so horrified by tragic stories and then also fascinated by them, because you immediately go, what would I do if that happened to me? How would I react? What would I be able to cope with that? So maybe that's, and also the other thing is, like, it's very relatable because nobody gets out alive. I think that at a certain point, everybody's going to, you know, contend with some massive loss, whether it's early or middle or late. I think you all get a bit of a spin. And if you don't, like, huh? How?
Yeah. Really, like, the only way you get out without someone you love dying is if you die first. That's pretty much it. I mean, like, mm-hmm. it's like, look to your left, look to your right. Those are all dead people. That's all pre-dead. Most of the people who ever were are dead and grieved in some way.
Yeah, that's how I look at. I call just regular citizens pre-dead.
Yeah.
You're all pre-dead.
Yeah.
But it's coming. No, that would be so weird. Sorry.
But that makes sense, though. I mean, like...
It's true.
These are about to be dead. And it's also like most of the time that your atoms spend in existence, you will be dead. You're alive for like this much time.
Yes.
But you'll be dead for so long. That's going to go on forever. The thing you were saying before about... being protective of other people's grief, I'm very in between on that, of like that concept of like I'm making this up as a metaphor I'm doing on the fly, so please be forgiving. But if it's like a balloon of grief, like, you know, when I was 14, the most grief I've ever felt was my girlfriend breaking up with me. And it, like, to me, that was like an insurmountable tragedy. And that's just as big as the balloon had ever been. It had never been bigger than that. So I'm like, oh, this is, you know, no more air will fit in here. Mm-hmm. And then something else happens and they're like, nope, there's space for more sadness in here. So I look back at the other balloon and I'm like, oh my God, I could fit so much more into that thing. I just didn't know.
Yep.
I think a lot of people, you know, their balloon has only ever gotten so full, and whatever the fullest your balloon has been, you're like, this is the only way that I can map the sadness of you losing your sister onto me is that once my girlfriend dumped me. And it's like, and those things are the same. And you're like, oh, wow, they are deeply not.
Yeah.
But also, there's no way to take that person. There's no way to be like, well, let me quickly... let me murder one of your parents so that you will understand how this is different.
I love the metaphor. I think it was very successful.
Wow. Okay.
I think you're 100% right. I think you don't have to agree that they're the same, but I guess it's like a bit of an exercise in empathy of just that's your limit. You know, that's as much as you can relate. Although I will say, like, look, social media has made monsters of us all, whether you're actively posting and participating or you're just like the lurker looking at it. You're still a monster in your own, whatever it is, because you're the judge. You get to judge without being vulnerable. So
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But I noticed that people, my observation, I'm not saying that this generalization is totally correct. I don't have the numbers. But my observation is that people that don't have real extreme loss often look for other ways to victimize, especially on social media, as if it is becomes an interesting personality attribute.
Yeah.
So that you can't criticize them for other things. No, actually, I have this. Other things are making me like a victim to like bad luck. And as somebody who's had major losses that, you know, I would say are traumatizing, I, for so long, never wanted to be seen as like a victim of anything. I thought it was really gross and like a scarlet letter. It felt shameful and weird.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I'm a weirdo for having so much loss. People are going to think that I'm fucking weird. So I have to be as normal and positive and peppy and just whatever about it, because otherwise I'm a freak. Losing your twin is freaky. Being a twin is already freaky. Losing a twin is double freaky.
Yeah, I think also because it's happening when you're a child. So I would imagine that it is like, could be very alienating because you're the only one who has the experience, and you also have almost definitely not the tools to express yourself.
No.
That you have now acquired as an adult.
Also, our entire town was like bearing witness. It was in the papers. It was this massive, you know, town tragedy. So then my family and you felt under this sort of social microscope because everybody was sad about the little girl who got hit by a car and died.
Where did this happen?
I grew up in a town called Mamaroneck outside of New York City.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And
there's a Metro North stop there, right? That's what I know about it.
That's what it is. Yep, it's a commuter town. And there were these four elementary schools, and me and my sister Sybil played Little League soccer. So that was how we met other girls from other elementary schools, because we played sports with them. So we had a big community from other schools. And so it was like a tidal wave in the community when my sister got hit by a car. She was in a coma for a week. And people were, you know, it was one of the most devastating things that had happened to our community at that time.
Wow. So did you have people when you were young? I mean, you must have, like, you went back to school at some point.
I went to school the next day. I was in school the entire time she was in a coma.
Wow. Was that because your parents were like, let's just try and make life regular? Is that the...
I mean, not to make trauma my brand. I like truly even asked my manager. I was like, is like grief stuff my brand now? Because I am getting a lot of podcasts for that. And I still want to be funny. But she was like, well, you have other things, but this is happening. No, but I was not allowed to go to the hospital to see my sister once she was taken there by ambulance. She had such a massive head injury and, you know, was in a coma. And at the time, the doctors were just like, this would not be good for your young daughter to see Sybil in this state. There was no precedent of what's the best way, you know, to help her in her teens and adulthood, trauma-wise.
Right. There's not a handbook for, like, what you do with a twin whose sister has just been hit by a car. There's no, like...
No. And also, you know, in my parents' defense, this was the worst thing that could have ever happened to them, wondering if their daughter's going to die, trying to do everything they can to save her while she's in a coma. It was probably best that, you know, I go to school and just not be something that you had to worry about at that moment. There was one thing they could worry about at that moment, not me.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them.
Well, first of all, I think that's very generous isn't the right word, but I think it's an easy is not the right word either. But I think it would make sense if that made you, if you were upset about that. And I think it's kind to not be.
I mean, I am very upset about it. And I was furious about it for my whole life. I'm very angry about it. Very, very upset. I'm furious I wasn't allowed to go to the hospital and say goodbye to my sister. I also think like maybe there was like twin power that like I could have saved her if I'd been able to hold her hand or that would have cured the like broken brainstem. Like,
sure.
You know, it's just delusional, but it was just anger and pain that I carried for so long that I didn't get to see her. But I am a grown-up now. And having been through some therapy, I can say that nothing my parents did was intentional to harm. That day in that experience, like had to have broken them beyond. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that day it's like every emotional system is flooded like, you know, 500 times over, and it's very hard to keep track of what the right thing to do is.
And the way that she died, you know, parents lose children and children get sick or there's accidents. But, you know, I think the guilt of we were young and walking by ourselves and didn't have a ride. And, you know, it's something that we had done before, but I think that there was a sense of, you know, did we not parent well? Was there a major failure here? Because if we had driven them, this accident wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be totally unavoidable.
Yeah, which, I think every parent, if their child even gets sick or is there more we could have done? Once you become a parent, your sense of being responsible for somebody else's life is that's all consuming.
Yeah. I said this on another podcast recently, but I do like parenting in and of itself, maybe not for everybody, but I think is traumatic just from the jump. Like birth is like an insane, mm-hmm. beautiful, but also traumatic event that you're just, and the whole time you're just like, every milestone, you're like, oh, I can't believe what is happening. I don't know. Now she's taller. Now she talks. Now everything is just like, how do I keep control of this? And there is no way. Mm-hmm. But that idea of what could we have done something different? I mean, I empathize with that so completely. Mm-hmm. And you know, in my case, my kid was in the hospital the whole time pretty much. So it's easy to be like, well, if this is anybody's fault, it belongs to the hospital. But there's definitely like, if I had been there and noticed 20 minutes before that nurse noticed that he wasn't tolerating his feeds or whatever, would that have made the difference? And the answer like really is maybe yes. And that's, mm-hmm. but that is your life. You know, if I had taken a different train on whatever day, I might not have met my wife and the whole thing would be different. I think it's hard to go back through every single step and be like, well, this is your fault because of all these things.
Yeah.
Do you remember being back in school, like how the world was different for you? Like people must have known and treated you differently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, the entire community during the week she was in a coma, they kept asking me. I was like so dissociated. How is Sybil? I was going to soccer practice. How's Sybil? And I just remember repeating over and over after my parents had told me, you know, by the sort of end of the week, well, she's in a coma and she's not going to wake up, because they had had to break the news to me. She's in a coma and she's not going to wake up. And then so now people are asking me, because I'm going to soccer practice and I'm going to school, how's Sybil? How's Sybil? She's in a coma and she's not going to wake up. She's in a coma and she's not going to wake up. And I'm saying it like I'm reporting the news.
Yeah.
It's just journalism. I'm 9 and it's just journalism, because that's the answer I've been given and people are curious. And then she died and we had the funeral, and it was the first time I rode in a limo, and I had wanted to ride in a stretch limo my entire life. And it was so glamorous. And I am there like, wow, a limousine. But it's because my twin is dead. And I remember all these friends and people from the community came to the cemetery where we buried her. And I had these school photos of Sybil that I had cut up because I knew people are going to want photos of Sybil. And it would be so nice of me if I handed them out so people could have a keepsake. And so I'm hosting at 9 years old my twin's burial and funeral, like it's a like I'm being a good host. Would you like one of these? Would you like this? Like, I'm taking care of other people's grief. I truly have no room for mine. I have become a host at this point at 9 years old. And, you know, my dad is wearing sunglasses because he doesn't want people to see him cry. My mom is not using the shovels to put the dirt on the casket. She's using her bare hands. And my mom always had such beautiful painted long nails. She was so glamorous. And I was like, wow, her bare, beautiful painted nails are in the dirt. And that really affected me. I knew she was different because her nails were getting so dirty. And then there were this giant mural that had been put up in the hallways of our elementary school with everybody's signatures. All the kids had written notes on it. This giant, you know, brown paper mural of, "We miss Sybil. We love you, Megan." And it was like I had to perform gratitude.
Yeah.
But I didn't want any of this attention. It was so, I felt like a freak. This was not the kind of attention I had ever wanted in my life. So to combat it, I was without any sadness or grief. I had no wants. I had no needs. I was fine. Oh my God, all these people are worried about me. I will give them nothing to worry about. That is so mortifying that they're worried about me. How embarrassing. If they're worried about me, it means there's something wrong with me. And, you know, I just want to be normal. I don't want to be a freak. I just want to be, you know, like a nerdy, smart kid in school who plays soccer, who's like, you know, trying to be popular.
Yeah, like a regular 9-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. So we talk to our kids about Fisher being dead. Like, that's something that is just like part of the house. Like, we, you know, sometimes we'll all be like in the bed cuddling or whatever. My son is getting too old to be cuddled, but I impose it on him like martial law. And we'll all be in the bed and be like, you know, oh, I love to be here with my whole family. And one of my kids will be like, oh, except for Fisher. And you're like, yeah, true. But you talked about that, the idea of people trying to use suffering as a thing about them that is interesting. And, Fisher died before my kids went to school. So they didn't have the same kind of experience that you had.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember that, I think it was Willa going to show and tell or whatever, and other kids being like, I have a frog or whatever. And Willa being like, oh yeah, my brother's dead. And be like, okay, well, that's that's a heavy moment for the class.
Yeah.
And I think it is that, a little bit, it's that desire to be like, of wanting the sense of specialness that you really did not want.
No.
But I think for you, it's way more real than it was, because neither of my kids ever met, you know, never knew their brother. It wasn't like they have memories of all the these things that they did together. Instead, it's like a curiosity. And I don't know how to talk about it with my kids. We just kind of make it up. So we tell them, and sometimes, like, you know, I've been with Truman and we watched some movie, like some Ben Affleck movie. And he asked me during the movie, it brought to mind some question about Fisher. And he asked me, and then he just started crying about it. And, you know, I'd never seen him have that like think about his brother and cry. I'd just never seen that happen before. Mm-hmm. And it's as a parent, I'm just trying to think about how people around you were trying to help you deal with it. Mm-hmm. I just have no idea, still having gone through it, I have absolutely no idea. Because everybody's well-meaning, right? Everybody's like,
yeah,
we'll put up the mural. I'll ask her. We'll all do all this stuff. And as a nine-year-old, you're like, oh my God, this is so much. This is so much. But it's very, is there anything that people can do in that time? How do you, I'm asking myself, you know, for my own kids too, like, what is it you do mm-hmm. What's the optimal way to do this? And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it involves giving you space to feel your own feelings so you don't feel like you have to, yeah, perform gratitude or perform I'm okay for all those people. But I don't know.
You know, it was also a different time. I think therapy is now like it's a graphic slide that you can just get off Instagram. But at the time, it wasn't like that. So, you know, people weren't as well versed. They didn't. And my parents tried to get me to go to a therapist right away. And they took me to a woman. And I had one meeting with this woman in front of my parents. And I was like, absolutely not. I'm not telling this woman my inner shit. I don't know this stranger. You want me to talk to her? What? This is some old woman behind a desk who wants to know how I feel. This is so sus. Is she the FBI? What the fuck is this? I'm not doing this. My mom was like, well, you really should do this. And my dad was like, Megan is upset. We are not forcing her to do this.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is causing a fight. I'm just not doing it. I'm bailing.
Yeah. Let's just keep it. Let's just keep everybody chill. What can I do?
Yeah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Did your parents, had they gone to therapy before? Was that something that was like part of your family life or no?
I was not aware that they had gone themselves. It had never been talked about. So I'm not sure, they may have. But they did a bit after, and then in my adulthood, a little bit. But it was not, again, especially for Jews, you'd think like therapy, the answer, let's go. Everybody's got their own private therapist in this household. But we did not, and it was a little bit, there was a little shame maybe attached at the time, or also suspicion.
Yeah, that checks out.
Towards therapists, which is not, you know, it's again, not very Jewish of them, but to feel that way. But that's just was the attitude. And then I didn't really go to therapy until I was in my mid-20s.
And now, since your sister died, you said I didn't know that your father died, but your father and your mother have both died as well. How long ago did your father die, may I ask?
He died 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago. So they died within like 5 years of each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I am winning the Grief Olympics. I'm winning.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We've got you on the leaderboard back here. There's a few people. You just hopped over them. You're in first place.
Okay. Thank you.
How, like, you obviously have to process all the grief and continue to from the loss of your sister. Your mother and your father also died. Do you feel like it's piling things on top? Does the grief feel like it grows, or is that not the right way to talk about it?
I don't know. I guess in preparation for even this podcast, contending with, oh, we're probably going to talk about like all these deaths and what is a way to talk about it? One thing I did pre-think about was like prep.
Okay.
Is losing somebody in an accident is very different than losing somebody in a long illness.
Sure.
So losing my parents was very brutal, and very sad. And both of them dying of cancer was also very Ashkenazi Jewish of them. Sorry, but it's, oh gosh, cancer. But it was very different than the shock of losing my sister in an accident.
Sure.
You know, because by the time, and both of them did home hospice. So I watched both of them contend with this illness and then pass away. We were there, and I have this, you've never really lived unless you've watched your parents die. but that is not funny, but it is. But yeah, it's very different watching somebody go through the illness to death process. It's a kind of very deep, profound, what it does to your own psyche and how you process grief is very different than losing somebody in an accident prematurely. It's just different. So losing my parents to cancer was deeply sad and a huge loss in my family system and in my feeling tethered to between childhood and suddenly I was definitely like no longer somebody's child. I am only adult. There is not a person on this planet that loves me unconditionally anymore. That's it. That part of my life is done. Huge grief, but it didn't feel tragic.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
You know, and something people don't talk about is when somebody's dying of cancer and in terrible pain and going through hospice and that care, that by the time they pass away, there's a moment of relief.
Yeah.
Which feels so fucked up to say, but somebody being ill for so long, there was like a relief at a certain point. Now, of course, I miss them terribly. You know, at times the stink comes.
Yeah.
I smell the smell of the grief, but it's not tragic.
Yeah. I mean, I understand that idea of like one thing that, so Fisher's, you know, death was like precipitous. He was, oh God, there's a problem. He was dead shortly thereafter. But there is a moment, a brief window in which they're like, you know, maybe he will survive. And if he survives, it will be horrible for him. Where they're like, you know, we could, if we were able to get everything absolutely perfect, then we would be able to, you know, reconstruct his bowel in such a way that he could live a very low quality of life for we don't know how long.
Mm-hmm.
And there is like, I'm not sure if it's ugly or what part of you that's like, oh, I don't, do I want that for, do I want, would that be a win? Would it be a win if he was incapacitated and, you know, barely sentient for an indeterminate period of time? So there is a sense of like, you know, maybe it's better for him to not, eventually we didn't have, there was no choice, but,
right.
But that feeling of.
Better to not have to make that choice.
That's part of the relief of like,
yeah.
You know, the universe being like, this is not going to be on you. And that sense for you of like, you know, I've been watching this suffering for so long. Maybe in a way it'll be nice when I don't have to watch it and they don't have to feel it anymore.
Oh, it wasn't even about me. The relief was that they weren't suffering. I mean, it was hard, but it was more, I mean, cancer is such a fucking bitch.
Yeah.
And the way it's treated is, I know that they'll evolve treatment for cancer, but the treatment is so brutal.
Yeah, my dad and my brother and my grandfather, all Jews, have also had cancer. And my grandfather died, but I do remember basically what you're saying, I think, which is the treatment is we're going to kill you.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to, like, here's a lot of poison and hopefully it dies before you die.
Yeah. And not only are we going to pump you full of poison, but you're going to have to keep coming back week after week, the time, the travel.
Yeah.
The spending time getting your infusion, the wearing of the chemo infusion bag, if you're not going to, the side effects of the chemo with, you know, what is it when you don't have iron in your blood?
Anemia?
And you, yeah, and you're going to be anemic and you're going to bleed out here and then we're going to have to, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So the relief that they, in some ways, it's not for me to judge what somebody's quality of life is and what they would prefer.
Sure.
But it was very hard to watch them endure the lessening of the quality of their life.
Yeah, of course. Does the grief that you feel, and maybe these are like, it's reductive to make it into one feeling, but does it help you ever? Like, is that something that you return to? For me, I don't have any memories with my son, really, like hardly. The sadness is almost the only thing that I have. You know, he died at 34 days old, so it's very little, like, I can't be like, remember when we played catch or whatever. So, like, remembering him, which will make me sad frequently, although sometimes not. Sometimes it's like, it's nice to think of him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like a way that I touch base, to be like, I remember, you know, this feeling of sadness is like a tie to his life. Does that mean anything to you, or does it sound foreign?
Well, are you asking me, is there something like, you didn't say this, but is there something enjoyable about the grief?
I guess what I mean is like, does the grief ever, I don't know if I would say enjoyable, but that's pretty close. I guess, does the grief ever make you feel good?
Okay.
Is it ever good to feel, do you ever feel sad about it? And are like, ah, that felt good to feel that for a second.
Not necessarily. It's almost like when people say, like, poverty builds character. And it's like, you've never been poor. that's something a rich person says. You know, fuck that. I would prefer not to have had any of this happen and be have zero character and be the biggest douche who ever douched around, sliming around my douche all over. Like, I'd love to be zero, no character and integrity.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
And trade that in for living parents and living twin. Yeah.
Yes. I agree with that.
Selling my flat tummy tea.
Just to go back over myself. I don't mean, are you glad that these things happened?
No, I know.
Okay, great.
No, I know. I'm answering a question you didn't ask.
Like, that would be a psychotic question to ask somebody.
No. No. But, so, no. And I guess I'm saying I don't really take pleasure in having the grief. And I don't even allow myself to feel smug anymore at having this grief. There's no smugness.
What do you mean by that?
Like, people are like, wow, you're so strong and resilient. You have resilience. You have strength. You've dealt with this. There's nothing you can't deal with. I have a lot of admirers because of my trauma.
Yeah.
And I'm like, are you deranged? But that doesn't, I didn't choose it. This is not real courage.
Yes.
Something bad happened to my relatives. They lost their lives. I am just still alive.
Yes, I agree with that so totally.
Like, the grief is almost like a little bit of a, if I can compare it to anything, which I don't say this to offend somebody with a disability, but it feels sometimes like a disability sometimes. It's like, I would love to just operate fully functional without the grief, but I can't. Sometimes I get sad for no reason. Sometimes, you know, yeah, I get really sad for no reason. Sometimes I feel this ache of loneliness and there's no cause. And the ache of loneliness is that I lost my twin. I wasn't born alone and I was not a baby alone and I wasn't a young girl alone. I was always paired. And you know, I think I searched my whole life for my soulmate and my pairing after I lost Sybil, after Sybil died. You know, I was just so achingly lonely. And the truth is, you know, I'm paired now and I have my quote unquote soulmate and married and very happy, but I still have that ache. And that won't go away. And I would prefer not to have it.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense to me. Yeah. Is the, when you talk about the grief that way, it makes it sound, it's like debilitating. Like you'll have these feelings of sadness and it's like, kind of like getting punched in the gut. Is it like that? But what I guess what I'm wondering is there ever any catharsis to that sadness? Are you ever like, you know, I've been feeling this low level sadness for a while. I can't really put my finger on it. Let me take 10 minutes and just lay down face down on my floor and sob and then be like, okay, now I'm ready to kind of move on.
Yep. That's kind of exactly how it goes now. It used to really, when I couldn't admit that it was the ache of losing my twin, when I was trying to be like in denial of this sadness and just go, go, go and be very normal and very special and very high functioning and sort of ashamed of the tragedy, it would kind of knock me out way worse. And now that I, let's use a therapy term, have integrated the loss.
Mm. Yes, wonderful.
When I feel sad and I feel choked up or I need to cry, it is a 10-minute, it's a 10-minute ordeal. It's a lie down. I have to go lie down for 10 minutes. I'm going to go cry. And it truly doesn't last longer than 10 minutes now. And again, it's sort of like, wow, I got swept away by the sea, but the shore carried me back. And that was pretty fast. Now I'm back on dry land.
Yeah.
But, and so I'm not lost at sea emotionally anymore. I can get back to dry land really fast.
And another question is, for me, it's been 12, almost exactly 12 years since my son died. It's not something that I think maybe like you are, less and less like immobilized by it sort of daily. You know what I mean? Like it's mm-hmm. something I'm always aware of and, you know, something will happen that feels totally random and it'll make me deeply sad for some reason about my son, but it happens less and less frequently, right? Like when he died, it's like, oh, the Macarena is playing on the radio and somehow my brain draws a line between the Macarena and my son. And I'm like, oh my God, that happens less now. Mm. There's part of me that is like, you know, this happened, intellectually I know this is wrong, but there's part of me, it's like, this happened 12 years ago. Why don't you get over it, dude? Like, you know, you could just not think about, maybe you just don't think about it anymore. And that would just be, wouldn't you just be happier that way? Do you ever feel that way? Are you ever like, geez, my sister died. It's horrendous. It happened, but it also happened. I was 9. Maybe now it's time for me to stop, I don't know, using it in whatever way you use it.
Well, it's funny because I spent so long ignoring it that it's only pretty recently that I feel it and acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And can talk about it. I couldn't talk about her. I couldn't tell people about her. I couldn't say her name. I celebrated my birthday solo all these years, that there was this invisible 9-year-old beautiful ghost that was like, it's my birthday too. And I was like, no, we're celebrating right now. I am. And it wasn't. And then I felt like a liar. So it's really only recently that I'm like, yeah, Sybil was here. Sybil is here. Sybil, you know, I was a twin. I am a twin. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, to other people's reality, I was, because she's not here to prove that I am a twin. We don't, you know, I don't have it. I don't have the evidence, you know, to answer your question, no, it's more present in a lot of ways now that I can maturely acknowledge it. It's not going to go away. It's not like something to get over. I'll never get over it. By the way, I made peace with that. I'll never get over it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that way also, but it is, you know, my brain sometimes is like, stop being like, you know, man up, for lack of a better phrase. There's a, you know, there's just times where you start to feel sad and your mind is like, come on, would you not? Would you just?
Yeah.
Like, it's similar to what you're talking about. Of like, you'll have a moment where it's my son's birthday and I'm like, it's also my other son's birthday. And like, you know, you're at your kid's birthday party. You're going to be sad now? You're an asshole.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what's so strange too. Sometimes, like, I can move my hand. There's something in me that's in charge of that. The coordination between like the brain and the body, that I can move my body and I can like, I can hold a plank in Pilates. It's up to me. I'm in charge. But you're not in charge of your emotions.
Yeah.
Something else is working there that you're like, actually, you're not in fucking charge
yeah.
of this machine.
Do whatever you want, bro. We got our own plans.
Yeah. Oh, we're crying now? Oh, you can't stop? Okay, cool.
Do you want to stop? Doesn't matter to us, actually.
Yeah. The more you want to stop is you're actually going to cry uglier
yeah,
and louder.
What's weird is the want to stop button is attached exactly to the do it more button, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You talked about your, do you need to go?
No, my gorgeous husband just walked in and I don't think he knows I'm doing a podcast. So
thank God.
I'm doing a podcast just a little bit longer.
I can't even.
I don't think he heard me. He has headphones in at all times. You know, he gets along with me because he always has headphones in and he can't hear me. Just kidding.
But that's an incredible trick for marriages. I'm sure that it works. Also, this isn't really part of the podcast, but since he's been brought up, I do feel like we should acknowledge, because it'd be incredible not to, that he is so hot. It's
thank you for saying that.
It's an absurd level of hotness. I've said it before. I probably will say it again. Like when I get off the podcast, I'm going to go talk to my wife and be like, you're not going to believe how hot her husband is.
No, everybody should check out my Instagram and know that he is so gorgeous. But a win for me, really, in the karma of life.
A win for us all, really.
Well, yeah. He happens to be incredibly smart and sweet, too.
Son, that's too much.
But I only like him for his looks. I do like him.
To U-turn back into what we were talking about in a non-professional way.
Yeah.
You talked about your birthday with your sister's ghost sort of being there, being like, it's my birthday too. As you're older than you were, he said, obviously. Do you think of your sister and your parents as like being someplace? Are they some, like maybe not in heaven or whatever specifically, but I mean just like anywhere, even figuratively.
Yeah. Yeah. This is sort of, you're asking like a bit my spirituality potentially. And I guess why be coy? It's sort of energy. It's like infinity. And
yeah,
I am not, I'm very arrogant, but I'm not arrogant enough to know with certainty that there's nothing after or that there's something. So my spiritual agnosticism is, I'll entertain the possibility.
Yeah, could be.
And why not if it kind of sometimes brings me relief? So when I'm feeling like my most poetic and natural and at one with, you know, the universe, I'm like, oh, everybody's here. Everybody who's ever been is here all the time. It's all just atoms and energy. And now my atoms and energy and is just moving in this thing, but that's not the only way to communicate. It's just the communication that I can understand.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so yeah.
Have you felt that way for like your whole life, or is that something you came to as an adult?
No, it changes frequently, like over the years. You know, I had many years of just absolutely no belief in God. Just like, what kind of sadistic motherfucker? And then I had years of almost OCD prayer belief in God. Okay, God.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I'm back. I need you. I got you. You got me. And Sybil's there too. Sybil is God adjacent. So I'm praying to Sybil and God. They are on the same plane. And between Sybil and God, and they are my higher power, we are taking this to the finish line of like success. And then I was like, that was hard and extreme. That was too much. We don't feel that way. And when I say we, like, there's a lot of times where I refer to myself as we still. My, and it's not for royalty reasons, you know? I do think of myself as living for two and being two. And a lot of my life is, it's me and Sybil. We are doing this. We're, you know. And so she is kind of still here. I guess it's my coping mechanism. I don't have proof yet. I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be very hard. It's very hard to prove. You're going to have to wait until you're dead to be able to prove it. And then I can't have you on the podcast.
I have to say that, like, I also psychotically entertain notions that I'm part of some government Nazi type of experiment where they're separating twins. And it was all, like, the world's most yucky prank. And I'll be reunited with her when we're old.
That is such, like, I feel like of our era to be able to believe that. Because I mean, I totally understand that feeling. It's very related to the idea that I'm the only real person. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I have that kind of feeling a lot. This is all like some experiment. But I do feel like Ashton Kutcher's Punk'd is like so imprinted on my childhood that it really could be like, oh man, we got you so good.
But I would be so forgiving because I would love to be punked. Like, oh, you did this. You made me think she was dead. She thought I was dead. But like, no, we were just like living these parallel lives. And now the experiment is over and you get to see each other again. I have dreams about being reunited. I'm like, yeah. Sometimes I feel like that idea, that delusion has kept me alive at times where I'm like, but what if you're going to be reunited? You have to stick around because you're going to have stories to tell Sybil when you get to see her again. And it's like, knock, knock, who's there? You're a cuckoo. Stop it.
But that ties very much into religion, that whole, again, with Fisher, I don't know if he's like, I don't know where he is. I don't have any like firm belief in anything, but there is like, I mean, would it be nice if when I die, I go someplace and watch my cousin Vinny with Fisher over and over again? Like, yes, that would be, I would like that. And so if I could believe it, I would for sure.
But if that is true, then that means you're going to be reunited like with all relatives. And I'll be honest that there's some relatives I don't want to see later.
Yeah. I don't need to see everybody. What?
I'm sure there's people that died before I ever knew them that I'd be like, ooh, this is boring. No, thanks. This is where we all go.
Boring is the best case scenario. I think boring would be lovely.
Right. But yeah. Sorry.
That's okay. You're doing great. He's got stuff he's got to do in there. I wanted to ask you one other question, which was submitted by a podcast listener named Joshua that I thought was a good question. And his question was, do you have any object that you keep that reminds you of someone who has died?
Oh, I'm a hoarder for my dead relatives. Any one object?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I feel so bad for my husband because he's living in a haunted house. Yeah. Oh, God. Well, so one of my most prized possessions, my parents went to Pratt. They met at art school. And my father was an architect. And sorry, you can hear me snapping more than you can hear the sandwich he's making, which my snapping is to have him be quiet making the sandwich. And you just hear my snapping. So I am just a fool and a nightmare. Anyway.
This is all an allegory for something, though.
Anyway, my mom... way before she ever had me and Sybil or had twins or I think even had my oldest brother, she painted a painting of twins. It's a beautiful, like, painting of these two women's faces. And they're just looking down at the audience and they have green eyes and long, thin nostrils and these lips. And she painted twins, and then years later, she had twins. And I have that painting up in our living room.
That's incredible.
Yeah, a little psychic artist. By the way, the nostrils of this painting are my nostrils. They are my green eyes, and Sybil's and my mom's as well. And it's just, it's insane.
That's really, I mean, that's the kind of thing also that would, I think, predispose someone to have a, for lack of a better term, like non-logical comprehension of what happens when you die, to be more just like, mm-hmm. like I think seeing a painting that your mom painted before you were born of you would make, if that had happened to me, I'd be like, I think of the world completely differently than the way I think of it now, which is just a bunch of chaos flowing in every direction.
I mean, look, it could all just be chaos, but there's so much of it happening. Of course, there's going to be coincidences. Like, she painted twins and then had twins. Like, there's so much movement on a subatomic level. Like, there's going to be collisions. But, you know, like, does my husband's first name mean twin? It does.
What?
That's his name means twin. It's Tomas.
I didn't know that meant twin.
Yeah. His name means twin.
That is amazing.
It's pretty wild.
Is he a twin?
He is not, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. When we went on our first date, you know, because I would like go on these dates and I was like, at what point do I say, like, I have a dead twin? It's just like such weird, you're like, I don't want to like trauma bond or like trauma dot, like, when do you decide to say it? And
Yeah.
I actually don't remember if I told him about my sister on the first date or not. And we had a wonderful first date, and I just remember we talked about so much. I think we talked about our father's passing away. But anyway, I came away from the date, I swear to God, and I was like, did he lose a sibling? He hadn't mentioned it, didn't talk about it, it didn't come up for him. And I don't know if I mentioned my sister and I just saw something the way he responded to it. But anyway, it turns out that when he was almost exactly my age, he had lost a baby sister.
Oh my. I mean, that's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it is what you're talking about. It's like, if you have a million people, then one of them, a one in a million thing will happen. Like, it's all like one in a million things are happening all the time.
Yeah.
But that is quite the coincidence.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, we don't talk about it. It's not really, everybody has a different way that they approach loss. But I just remember feeling like I had known before he had told me.
Yeah.
I there was something between, I felt this kinship of something way before I knew. And then it was there.
Yeah, and you also have an ability to notice that other people don't have. Like, you must have, mm-hmm. like, the people who have suffered this kind of suffering vibrate on a different level. Like, that I definitely believe. That, like, I can sit with someone for 5 minutes and be like, I know how, to go back to the metaphor, I have a pretty good sense of how big your balloon has gotten.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Megan, I think that was the podcast. I think we did it.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to keep doing it? We could keep doing it. We could go forever.
Oh my God. I just have some underpants that I want to point people to the website. I thought that's what we were going to put.
Yeah. Please make up a name of the website right now.
Okay. www.sadpanties.com.org.biz.
Yeah. Got to get all those. Make sure you don't leave off the .biz or it's a whole different sad panties company.
Yeah. It's a nonprofit and it's also a biz.
Oh, it's a nonprofit. That's really great.
But yeah.
Uh-huh. This is episode 9 of A Good Cry with Megan Nuringer. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfeder, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.